This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about self-harm and DBT, a particular approach to therapy that we've talked about a few times on the show, and which I'm very glad to say is growing in usage. It's being recommended for more and more mental health conditions, and in the episode, we get into some of the reasoning for that. So definitely one to look into if you're exploring options for yourself. And a quick hack maybe to keep in mind is that oftentimes when it comes to waiting lists, there can be great disparity depending on the type of approach you are looking for with counselling. And oftentimes CBT is one that has lesser waiting lists. But I have known of cases where it's any number of approaches, including DBT, partly because a lower proportion of people are forwarded for it because it is a newer approach partly. So there's a few thoughts off the top of my head. Today's guest, Dr. JJ Kelly, is a licensed clinical psychologist, emotional intelligence skills training expert, and best-selling author of the Holy Shit series. Essentially, the titles go holy shit, and then whatever it is you've realized is the problem. And in particular, in today's episode, we're talking a lot about her book related to self-harm and really, you know, kicking down the doors of a lot of the stigma and misconceptions around this in a way that is very distinct to our guest. She's a lot of fun. She has such a distinct perspective on mental health treatment and is so, I guess the only way I could describe it is she's so alive with passion for her profession, and in particular how it impacts the lives of the young people that she works with. And I was so looking forward to this conversation. She did not disappoint. We got into so many different elements of mental health through this episode, and we had a good laugh along the way. We seemed to really get on. And if you are one of the people that has joined our subscription service on Apple Podcasts for ad-free episodes and also the bonus debrief chat after the episode, you'll hear she even gave me a very special invite because we got on so well. And that is all the spoiler I'm going to give right there. But for now, we'll get into this brilliant conversation with Dr. JJ Kelly in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
I'm Dr. JJ Kelly, and I have always been told that shrinks are born, not made. The only reason anybody ever goes into the profession of mental health is one reason: family of origin. That can mean a lot of things, but for me, it's probably, you know, narcissistic family system. And, you know, nobody as a kid knows what that means. But I often thought of it as like dancing as fast as you can. You gotta like, woo, have the show, be the best, be on stage, perform, whatever. And as I got older, I remember something pissing me off so deeply over and over. And that's when one of my parents, or even the aunties, like, you know, the family system is beyond, you know, the nuclear family. Mm-hmm. It's the whole gang. So when someone be like, oh, JJ, do that thing, like, do the thing. And it's like, what thing? You know, like, what are we talking about now? I'm supposed to like do a line that was funny when I was four or something like that. I remember somebody was like, ooh, JJ, do the thing. And I was like, I'm 40 motherfucking years old. Like, I am not your dancing monkey. And my dad goes, oh, come on. Yes, you are. Oh, like light bulb. Like, this is how it's always been, man. Oh, yes, you are. No, I'm not. I'm actually a freestanding individual that makes choices for themselves. Mm-hmm. And it still was happening. And like, I didn't know it was narcissism as a kid. I didn't know what that word was, but I knew it was, you know, supporting actor mm-hmm. in somebody else's play. And I think you're supposed to be the lead in your life, you know?
Yes, and that contrast is wild of both that awareness, yes, you are the dancing monkey to them, but also total lack of awareness that there's a problem with that.
Totally. Isn't that the narcissistic way? The delusional way of thinking, no, the sky's green. I mean, how do you argue with that? Okay, the sky's green. What fucking ever?
If they're really that convinced. And actually, that's something that I've come across, luckily not as much firsthand, but certainly like in a lot of friends of mine that have been around narcissistic people. For whatever reason, there's been a bit of a trend with friends of mine where it's like parents-in-law that have those traits. And because mm-hmm. the person that they're dating is somewhat, you know, ground down by those behaviors, they often can't either see it or it's too difficult to acknowledge the extent of it. And then for you being on the other side, you're protective of your partner, but you don't want to come between them and their parents.
But you do too, because it's so messed up. I know, yes. And they're everywhere. So like, you're like not much firsthand experience, yeah, that you know of. Like, they're everywhere, dude.
Yeah, but I guess maybe part of it is I've learned maybe the hard way that oftentimes if people are really stuck in that mindset, if everything in the world does relate to them and they can't currently see beyond that,
yeah,
oftentimes you just have to walk away. You know, somebody has to want to change. And I think that's why, as damaging as narcissism is, I can see the root of pain that so often is wound up in it. And therefore, if somebody's not willing to challenge their own behavior and maybe get the help or try and work on themselves, you have to walk away, because otherwise anything you do only ends up feeding it. You know, you give them praise, it feeds the narcissism. You give them criticism, it feeds the narcissism. Particularly, I think the extreme that I witness is like victim-based narcissism, because then it doesn't matter how much you rail against certain behaviors, that adds to their victim complex and stepping away and being like, oh, I'm not giving you any energy of any kind. For me, has been sometimes the way you have to protect yourself.
Dude, I'm so impressed with that description. Like, legit. A lot of people do not have that level of understanding of narcissism and the narcissistic dynamic and not feeding it. I mean, that's why I wrote the book on it, because everybody thinks narcissism is just a synonym for asshole, but it is so much deeper than that, and layered and on a spectrum. Although I say the same thing you said, but differently, the only way to get free is to radically accept being misperceived as the asshole. Because everything ends up being your fault with a narcissist, right? So it's like, yeah, fine. Like, whatever.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You can't give it any energy. Yeah.
That's right. So we agree very much so. And damn, nice one, dude. Seriously.
Well, while we're taking down misconceptions, then one of the themes for today's episode is self-harm. And before we get into that, could you share a little bit about how you got into the work that you do, and particularly working with young people? Because am I right in thinking it was not on purpose so much as it was people perceiving like your personality, your humor and zaniness and being like, you'll be able to handle the kids. And a lot of people in your profession, particularly teens, they don't want to go near them.
Yeah, they don't. Because they're like, they've got like a bullshit sonar, you know? And shrinks are doing the like, put together thing. Tell me about your mother shit, you know? Like, they're all doctors. And so there's that whole persona of like knowing it all and not knowing where to send these young people who are like, you know, the freaks and misfits. And those are not by my standards. Those are my people, you know, like the gifted misfits, you know, the ones that are artists and poets and punks and musicians and, you know, the creative types mostly. They're often really quiet and sad and kind of stuff anger because they're sweet. And they don't know what to do with all that anger. And it's scary to deal with. Mm-hmm. And they're often just anxious and sweet. I think a lot of it, too, is that the psychiatrists and psychologists were like, I don't know what the hell to do with you. Go to JJ. Like, Dr. Kelly will straighten you out on that one. But when we're talking in terms of self-harm, there's always an anger component. At least that's what I have seen over the last couple of decades.
Yeah. And I guess I can really see the parallel there, because so much of, particularly for teens, the experience is around like an overflowing of emotions, exacerbated by life changes, exacerbated by hormones, figuring out who you are, and along the way often realizing, oh, maybe I am a person with issues, and you know, I'm struggling to handle them, and is it going to be too much to handle to speak up about how I really feel? And so then if they're met with an adult that they can't relate to, who does seem very kind of stuffy, I guess, in a way, and who maybe is intimidated by their level of emotions and their concerns about the state of the world, that so often with young people are valid. You know, young people coming up now worried about climate change. Yes. Adults don't have the answers either. And, you know, if you are coming with this mix of emotion and concerns about the future and who you are going to be in it, and then someone on the other side has a clipboard and doesn't seem to have a lot of answers for you.
Give me a break. Like, I wanted to be the kind of shrink that I needed when I was a kid. Like, the first time I got sent to therapy, I didn't say a word. I sat there. That poor bastard. I sat there in the room for whatever, 60 minutes, 60 days, Jesus, and just sat there like mean mugging him the whole time. He'd ask a question, and I'm like. So when, you know, when young people try that with me, I try to not laugh out loud because I'm kind of like, oh yeah, I feel you, kiddo. But I just sit there and I wait. And I kind of in my mind and like, I don't know, maybe with my heart, I'm like, come on, kid, you can do it. You can work through it. It's all right. You're scared. You're mad. It's okay. Like, I just silently sit there and, you know, wait for them. And they check, right? They check to see if I'm still looking at them, mm-hmm. if I give a shit, if I'm still plugged in to them. But anybody that has the strength of will, even though in the moment it's not really doing anything except making them more anxious, but just that strength of will, the like attempt to ice me out, I'm kind of like, respect, like, you're getting in your own way, but I know that you don't know that, you don't know me yet, you think I'm like every other adult that's not actually listening to you, like, give it a shot. Go for it with the like silent treatment. Let's see how you do. Mm-hmm. And I just wait, because none of them have done a full session like I did at 14. So whatever, what am I going to say? I did the same thing, but much, much worse. So I'm kind of like, all right, man, like when you're ready.
Mm-hmm. And I love that approach because it must be so refreshing for people. And I think particularly around topics of self-harm, so often the reaction can make things worse. That the reaction that's coming from a good place of fear, of concern, of wanting to kind of jump in and oftentimes unknowingly control the person into not doing the behavior when you know so often the behavior is an offshoot from the emotional overwhelm that really needs addressing, right?
Oh my God, beautifully put. Yes, I could not have said that better myself. No shit.
You were nodding away. And so when you're dealing with parents of young people, how do you approach the conversation of them coming to you desperate to know, why is my kid doing this?
I say, send your kid to me. I don't do much parent work. That's why I wrote The Cutting Book, because that's a parenting manual. I can tell parents everything that they need to know without messing with the trust of the privacy of the relationship with the kid. Mm-hmm. I found out through trial and error a very long time ago that the only way a kid's going to tell me everything is if they for sure know I'm not narking on them to their parents. Mm-hmm. And that is the standard, that the person who pays the bill gets to know the information in the mental health world. And I 100% do not ascribe to that. Even if they're under 18, no. Nope.
Yeah, because that's usually the caveat, right? That if they're under 18, then the rules around confidentiality are usually different. And I can understand some of why that is the case, but also I can see that, you know, how that does make it so difficult for you to then build trust.
Yep. And it makes parents anxious a lot of the time. So, you know, that's why I started with The Cutting Book, because I just like, manage your own anxiety. If you don't like my approach, don't send your kid to me. You know, that's a shame, because, you know, the kid 99% of the time connects with me and I can help them and they are happier having worked with me. But I put in the contract something to the effect of back the fuck off, or I'm going to stop seeing your kid and keep your money. Yeah. Like, do not, because they get anxious and then they're like, you can tell me anything in an email, anything you want me to know, but you won't get a response unless it's an emergency.
Right. Well, much like being in the therapy yourself, there often is that downward first. As you find out and kind of dig up the extent of the issues and what they root to then know the scale of, okay, now what do we need to work on? And so then if a parent is having that part, but because they're not in the room themselves, they're not witnessing the breakthroughs. They're not being there to see that actually there is really dark stuff coming up, but you're working to create a safe space where that isn't a spiral, but is instead something that can be managed and to an extent put away at the end of a session, at least in a way where they can walk away and not feel totally panicked, but still know, okay, there's a lot to do here.
And they can see the changes in their kids. Mm-hmm. You know, as anxious as it might make them that I don't do collateral meetings with them, they watch the sparkle come back into their kid. So, you know, they know things are happening. And the second one that I wrote, the second book I wrote, is the 8-week program. So if they want to know what's going on in the meetings, read that one. Just go read, go listen to it on audio, like whatever, because I got some work to do. And I can, you know, working with your kids' emotions is my job. Managing your fear is not. I don't, you, money was for this with your kid, not to manage your anxiety. Mm-hmm. They do have an entitlement with the money a lot of times. And I say it right before I take a dime. I'm like, this is how I work. You might not be used to it. So figure it out before you pay me.
And in terms of working with the kids and in the sessions, what kind of misconceptions do you find that the clients themselves have around self-harm?
I mean, the only one that comes to mind of what the, because they understand it. Mm-hmm. You know, they also understand a lot of times that the shame comes from it. Like, they wouldn't do it if it didn't work, quote unquote. You know, it does regulate their emotions in that moment. Yet there's a shame bill that's handed to them. I mean, most everybody I work with, regardless of age, understands that. They don't want to do it. They just don't know what else works, which is where my emotional intelligence skills come. You know, we talk the self-harm right into the ground that first meeting, because I want them to know there is 0% shying away from it on my part. So we talk all about it. They show me, you know, arms or whatever. We get really intimate about the self-harm and that process. And usually what happens after that is we don't talk about it a lot after that, because most people will use healthy skills that work instead of self-harm if they work. Mm-hmm. Because those are the tools I teach are shame-free, because they're based on the individual's values, not mine, theirs.
Yeah. And yeah, I think there's such a key there as well with the shame part from you, that you are providing right. shame-free tools, but also there's not any element of, oh, you should feel ashamed for this way in which you've felt is helping you cope.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great catch. Because what I was going to say to your, what are the misconceptions of the people that self-harm? Not a ton, but one of them is that no adult is going to understand. Mm-hmm. And that's what like is disarming about our work together, is that, yeah, I got it. I get it. I'm not going to judge you for it. I understand the emotion regulation piece and the shame piece. And we just talk about it very matter-of-factly right away, so they know that I get it. And then that's a trust segue to, and we can do these instead of the self-harm. And Christ, it's been 20 years of it working.
Yeah.
Like the way I talk about it, I think they must know that I know, just because I think people can hear the truth. They can feel the truth when they hear it.
Mm-hmm. And one of the misconceptions I think I come across a lot, which I can understand where it comes from, but there can be this mentality of wanting to make that person understand the consequences of the behavior as if they don't already realize. And having gone through enough of it myself, when it's, you know, harm that you are having to live with the recovery from, on top of the stuff that you're struggling, that's contributing to the, you know, the feeling to do this in the first place, you're just adding extra layers there. And you don't need to tell somebody the consequence of something they can see right there on their body, or in whatever form that harm shows up.
Totally. That is, oh man, that is so key. And to shame them on top of their own shame, like, that's that doctor worship thing that I hate. Besides all the isms in the field of mental health, I mean, in society in general, it's that doctor worship thing. This like, I know best and you're sick. Like, no, you don't. The person knows them better than you know them. It has to be a collaboration. I say, like, I'm the expert on these skills. Yes, I am. And I own that. And I'm great at what I do. And I can't do shit for you unless you let me know you, because you're the expert on you. We have to work together. I can't make people do things. I don't wrestle kids physically to like stuff. You know, that's ridiculous. It has to be like working together. And that's based on like trust and mutual respect, not this shamey doctor thing, the finger wagging. That's not healing. Mm-hmm. Get them to comply, but then when they're not in your presence, they're just going to do what they're going to do, and then they're not going to tell you shit.
Yeah, and for me anyway, there's additional dangers in that, of people feeling the understandable instinct to hide self-harm, but then if that's encouraged by the reactions you might get about it, even if those reactions from the people that really love you are from that place of love, can drive the behaviours further down. You know, you hide it more, you maybe potentially do it more.
Yeah, that whole road to hell is paved with good intentions. In psychological terms, that's intention versus impact. You might have love and probably fear behind saying something like that, yet the way it lands is not the way you want it to land, and it often drives people who self-harm underground more so. And that's the whole thing. It's so secretive because of the shame. Everybody wants to hide out from shame. And then you put like professionals who fear it, the parents who fear it, the teachers who fear it. And I think the fear is valid, maybe not in the professionals. They're supposed to know. But I understand how it creates fear in the people that love them. It's just if those people don't have the skills, the emotional intelligence skills to regulate their own fear, they're going to barf their fear onto the person that's already struggling. And now they have a bigger burden. Yeah, that does not help. But, and nobody understands that process. You do, which is impressive. I'm telling you, I hope you know how much you know compared to the like average bear. Like,
I think I'm used to it because I do this show week in, week out. But yeah, I do. I think I take it for granted still when I have conversations with people about mental health, and it often takes them coming back to me and they're like, you know, that was the first time I ever told anyone that. And then I'm like, oh, right. But that's not the first time anyone's told me that thing, but it is right. The first time right. For them.
Right. Well, that says a lot about you and your openness and a non-judgmental stance that people come to you and say that kind of very intimate, that's intimacy.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. But it's something that, you know, I stand by, and I think is part of the reason why I so enjoy interviewing people from the counseling profession, because there is so much crossover. For me, a big part of my background that influenced this was being a Samaritans volunteer. So are you aware of Samaritans?
I'm not, no.
So Samaritans is a listening service for people that are in emotional distress or feeling suicidal. And it's majority run by volunteers across the UK and Ireland. And it's an incredible service, 24/7, 365 days a year. You know, you hear so much, and the training is really brilliant from it. And so much of my experience, like knowing counselors, going to counseling, and also other work I've done in the mental health space, you know, it informs how I approach people. And luckily, it also seems to really help with interviewing because I do get to have the conversations that you don't hear elsewhere.
You know, psychologists and psychiatrists, I've known a lot of them, and the majority don't have the vibe plus the intelligence. The openness that you have and your level of understanding is rare.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And whilst it's weird for me to put nice things about me, I do think there is an important point here that, you know, might seem like a bit of a contrast, because I'm super pro-therapy. But also, I think we can't lose the fact that, you know, therapists are people too. And so my kind of worst fear with people trying to get this kind of support is that somebody has one bad experience and then writes off the entire profession.
Mine too, which I think is really common. You know, and the pandemic has thrown people into the mental health system in droves. So the general public has a raised awareness that, oh my God, I don't have any emotional intelligence skills. I better get some, which is great in a way, except my worry is that I won't speak for your country, but mine, that the mental health system still is a major part of like patriarchy, elitism, whiteness, you know, homophobia, like that stuff is really still very built into the system that people are now throwing themselves into. And so it worries me that people aren't going to get the help that they need. But I try to just focus on like building this thing that's different instead of like burning all that down, which was my initial impulse. And then just build something else that actually works for making people happy, because happy people act right, and then they'll just come here and that stuff will go extinct.
Yes.
You know, whatever.
And you know what? I think there is something that I've learned that reassures me, which is that the help can be imperfect. And part of what you described of like the client ultimately being the person that, you know, day by day is the one living in their body and living in their experience, mm-hmm. is in a way a protective method for that. So as long as counseling can uplift and empower people in the way that it should, then I think even imperfect help can still go a long way. And, you know, ultimately that's always going to be the case. You're always going to be a part of your own recovery because you are still the one, you know, doing the work and living it.
Agreed.
24/7.
Agreed. Yeah, I'll stop there. I do agree with that point. I have other worries about it, having been on the inside. I do think that there are plenty of people that can do great work with a mediocre shrink. Just shop. People need to shop instead of just take the first one that, if they don't connect, don't stay.
Yeah.
And I think that's the doctor worship thing, is like people just do what a doctor says. But if doctors are imperfect people too, and you don't connect, don't stay.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think part of this as well can be exacerbated by people not being empowered with the information around mental health in general, but also specifically with this, around different types of counselling and therapeutic approaches. And so for yourself, I know you're a major advocate of DBT, which we've talked about many times on the show. And I was saying to you, I've never met anyone that's actually had a bad experience with DBT, which I can't say for most approaches.
That's awesome. I have, but, you know...
No, what yeah, I'm saying
people
is...
People aren't perfect.
Yeah, no, of course. What I'm saying, I guess, is that I find it such a valuable approach, and I'm really glad to chat to you about it, yeah. Because for some background for the listeners, if you're unfamiliar, DBT is its kind of closest cousin is CBT in the counselling world, and similarly, it has that practicality to it. It has that... you know, element of empowering the client with tools that they can use straight away. And so often that's why you see nowadays CBT being usually the most accessible approach, because for those that are, you know, most in crisis and need the help most urgently, sometimes you need an approach like CBT to even get them into the room to do any work on the deeper level stuff. If someone yep. can't stop having panic attacks, they're not going to be able to work on what the underlying issues are. They need, okay, how do I try and manage my emotions in these moments of crisis? And I think that can have like really broad practicality, not just in the extremeness of mental ill health.
Agreed. Agreed. But it increases quality of life every year you do it.
And then DBT in a way kind of builds on some of those approaches by going in with a particular focus on not being triggering. And so is when we've talked about it on the show, is most commonly talked about in relation to PTSD and borderline personality disorder as two conditions that it's often recommended for, right?
Yes, originally. I have adapted it to work for anybody. Like, it's great for OCD and bipolar and for panic attacks and anxiety in general. But there isn't anything it isn't useful for.
And so hopefully I've given a good enough summary of what it is. And could you tell me a bit more about how you landed on that as a big part of your approach?
Yeah, I'd like to just add, because dialectics, people don't know what that is generally. So a quick way to explain that in terms of DBT is the Venn diagram. Everything in my whole world is the Venn diagram, the two circles intersecting and finding middle path kind of stuff. So with DBT, it's, you know, Zen mindfulness meets cognitive behavior therapy. And like, that's, I mean, the interpersonal effectiveness skills are like the best assertiveness training I've ever seen. But it's two things that are seemingly opposing, existing in an integrated, harmonious, and balanced way. That's what a dialectic is. So you are finding, it's not black or white, it's gray, and everything's gray. Like, certainty's not real, nor is control. So I try to teach people how to regulate the natural fear that comes with accepting that reality is gray. Mm-hmm. Ambiguity scares people. So that's why they push it to a poll of definitely being right or whatever. Well, that might match your values. Someone else might have different values. So we all have to find the behaviors that match our values, regardless of how emotionally activated we are. Most everybody can choose a decent behavior when they're calm, mm-hmm. but when they're off their own baseline, all kinds of impulsive behaviors that cause messes can happen. And we're trying to reduce those. And then when they, you know, when we inevitably do them once in a while anyway, how to go and repair any sort of damage that might have come about from what we call in DBT willful behavior.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess along the path there, trying to find ways to navigate the damage that can be done to your own perception of self. And I think that's something that can be so difficult to unpick around self-harm, exacerbated by how generally societally it's very misunderstood. It can be very easy to internalize that and really believe, how dare I do this to myself?
Totally. And, you know, there's something a little bit healthy about feeling shame when you hurt yourself on purpose. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, if you're not supposed to be cool with it, it actually shows that you know. People that self-harm know that it's not healthy, much like people with OCD know that their compulsions aren't rational. They just kind of can't not do them because it's the only thing that works to regulate their emotions. But when they're handed something else that's healthier and it works, shit, everybody's going to choose that thing. Mm-hmm. It's just that they've been offered or have it pounded into them, strong-armed into all kinds of things that don't work. So they naturally don't trust anybody saying anything about what works. They don't trust that at first. I don't blame them. Don't nobody should trust me right out of the gates. I mean, or anyone. Like, that is an earned thing. And yeah, okay, my presentation of like authenticity, sure, you could probably trust me quicker than other people, but, you know, trust your gut. That's the thing. That, and then if you in yourself, in your own resonance and perception, are like, okay, maybe I'll take a chance with this person, great. Then I'll earn that little by little. I'm not going to expect compliance.
Yeah. Because every approach is different. And one thing that, you know, often comes up for me is like in my relationship with my counselor, we often laugh. We often like have a lot of fun in the sessions. Of course, not all the time. Of course, not every session. But there's humor in it for me. And I think for me, that's something that I need as part of my recovery, to find ways to both find novelty in certain behaviors, many of which might not be healthy, but also, you know, the love and the understanding of, okay, I can see how I got irrational about this thing, and I can see the humor in it rather than hating myself and pushing it down and doing it more. And I guess, you know, that's what you're trying to do with a lot of your clients in your approach, that you're finding ways to turn that shame into, okay, how can we make that impulse that there is something better go from shame to hope for better tools?
Yeah, I think humor is a great vehicle for both trust and connection and also just emotion regulation. I mean, laughter does calm down the central nervous system. So not only are you relaxing as you do it, we're now being human beings together. It's not like doctor knows and patient does. I mean, I don't say patient, but like, yeah, humor is fantastic. I think it bonds people really quickly and is definitely underrated, if not pathologized, in mental health. I mean, your professional sounds rad. that's great. Lucky you, and good job them. Like, a lot of times it's pathologized that humor is merely a defense. And sometimes it is, but not all the time. Again, black and white, not few things are always or never.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sometimes thing. And to laugh together and to find levity in a very serious world with a very serious topic, like, I think that is helpful as a vehicle to healing.
Well, there's a very distilled common ground in it, you know, to be feeling the same emotion to the same extent where you can both laugh. And yet, exactly like you describe, you can imagine, sometimes I mention like a funny conversation I had with my counsellor, and I guess people are fairly used to me talking about counselling openly, but that can still be the one thing where people's face, when I tell a joke that she told, or that something that we laughed about, and they're like, huh?
Oh, I know. That's why I don't say what I, you know, being on air like this, a quote from me that I said to somebody yesterday could potentially horrify your audience. Like, the person I'm with gets it. You know, all my advanced students that we do the coaching call, they get it. They know me. They know what I'm doing. They know what I'm trying to do. You know, humor shame the behavior so that we can laugh at this thing and externalize it at the same time, so it isn't a burden that's internalized. We pull it out here and we laugh at it. Like, there's method to the madness, but I do ride an edge that, if taken out of context, could, yeah, definitely at the very least raise eyebrows, if not horrify people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. You have that level of awareness, and that's great. And I think sometimes that can be a challenge of the profession, that this is a work that is so necessary to do with a level of privacy and confidentiality. And yet sometimes that can deny the professionals in this field the comparison that might be helpful of, like, how can I ever expand on my tools? You know, there's a reason why counselors tend to train in one discipline, and then as they do it, they see, okay, there's more to add here. You know, it's no coincidence that, you know, you rarely find someone that's just using one approach.
Oh, yes. That's like an unspoken thing. Everybody's doing an eclectic approach. Give me a break. I mean, I'm still a licensed psychologist. I do coaching, though, so that I don't have to adhere to any of that anymore.
Yeah, I get that. And as we start to wrap up, because unfortunately we are coming near the end of our time, and I could talk to you all day.
I know, that was so fast. It's a good sign.
I want to pick up on something that I loved from your book in particular. It's called Holy Shit, My Kid Is Cutting. And I love the title. It's very you. I remember you said one particular bit, which I had to listen to like a few times. It really moved me, about seeing the hope and the spark return to the faces of the kids that you work with. Could you share a little bit about what it's like to see, you know, kids really come back to themselves?
It's tough to do without crying, you know? Like, it's such a special privilege and pleasure to be invited to see someone, to really see them. Like, they open themselves, and that the shit they tell me and the way that they just have a naked honesty. Like, so infrequently in the world are we filterless, and we just are ourselves together, flaws and all, just like letting it all hang out and being weirdos together. And that, I think that's the good stuff. And when they've taken those risks to show me who they are, and they see the authentic delight on my face, to like, yeah, let's do this. Let's be this together. Let's laugh. Let's cry. Let's just tell the truth. It is an invitation that lasts. I see them, they trust it now. They not only don't get a reprimand, they get a genuine yeah, yes. And they become more of themselves as time goes on then. And every bit of them I get to see is such a delight. And I just never get over the privilege that and pleasure, those go together, that I feel getting to be in the presence of someone that brave and someone genuinely healing. I can see people I can see what they're going to be before they do. With all those layers of programming and shit were taken away, I can see, but then they have to become it. They have to actually remove the layers. It's so terrifying for them. I know how real that is. And then to present yourself to the world and be like, fuck it, this is who I am. How few people do that. And then I get to be around tons of young people that have the courage to do that. And I played some part in that process. Like, I could die happy tomorrow, you know? Like, it's spectacular. It's the best job ever.
Oh, I love that. What a lovely place to wrap up. And so if people want to find more of your work, your wonderful writing, where should they go online?
They should probably just start at drjjkelly.com. It's all there. I mean, the Instagram, I just started a TikTok, YouTube, all of it's just Dr. JJ Kelly. But the website can lead you to everything, the books, the audiobooks, all that jazz.
Brilliant. Efficient. I love it. And in a moment, we'll be back for our Apple Podcast subscribers with more chat. But for now, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.